Bang, bang.
Hello, and welcome to Fang Bangers Podcast. We're chaotic horny friends rewatching the chaotic horny HBO series True Blood. I'm Lossie.
I'm Tessa. This week, we're discussing Season 2, Episode 8, Time Bomb. This episode originally aired on August 9th, 2009. It was written by Alexander Wu and directed by John Dahl.
And our summary from the wiki is, having saved Sukir, Godric, that's a weird way of pronouncing his name, Godric orders Eric to leave the premises with her and to do so peacefully. Unfortunately, Steve Newlin and his followers are waiting for them in the church, and he isn't too choosy as to which vampire they use for their sunrise ceremony. Godric tries a different approach and hopes to make peace with Steve, who adamantly opposes any such possibility. Safely returned to their lair, Godric's peaceful approach and lack of desire for revenge doesn't sit well with some of his followers. Steve also has a surprise for him. In Bontemps, Eggs tells Tara that he's blacked out again, and they try to piece together where he's been. Marianne prepares a special dish for them. Bleh. Sam Malotte finds himself under arrest when Daphne's body is found in the restaurant freezer. Having finally slept together, Jessica and Hoyt discover a disadvantage to Jessica being a vampire. So, first impressions on the episode.
I, like many of these episodes, was very impressed with the pacing of this episode. A lot of stuff happens. I mean, you just read, you know, two paragraphs worth of information about these episodes. I mean, and I think that that's a real strength of this whole series, is just how much they managed to put in each episode. Like, it's very fast paced. Like, if you blink, you're going to miss an important, you know, plot point or an important character moment. And so, especially because this really wraps up the Steve Newlin church plotline for now. Steve Newlin will return. But, you know, it's really kind of the climax of this plot that's been building for most of the season. You know, where is Godric? You know, what's happening to him? What are they going to do? What are they planning? All of those things kind of get resolved in this episode. But then there are other things that are still ongoing, that are still building, like the stuff back in Bontemps, the stuff with Eric, you know, we're kind of setting up some new storylines as well. There are just so many genuinely good characters at this point in the season, and the show is so well balanced about serving them. It never feels like somebody is being done dirty at this point. That will be a complaint later on. It doesn't feel like, you know, it feels like everyone has something to do, and it's always interesting. There isn't like a plot line where I'm like, well, I just don't really care about that. Not at this point, anyway.
Yeah, I think Steve Newlin will return is the post-credit stinger that no one ever asked for. But
no one wants. No one asked for it. It was forced on us.
I agree. I think it's an episode where, by True Blood standards, not a lot of plot happens. But the amount of character work that happens is really, really great. It's
the dialogue is so good.
The dialogue's really good. I will say the writing in this episode is, for dialogue particularly, is really, really sharp. There are a lot of really high quality jokes from multiple people, and there's some deep lines. Like, there's some great lines from Eric that you're like, well, okay, all right, fair enough, mate. So yeah, I agree. I think it was I really enjoyed this episode. And it's also an episode that some of the darkest, creepiest shit that's happened in this season happens in this episode too.
We get some real horror shit.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so I think we've only got sort of 2, 3, 4 plot lines, maybe. So let's kick off with the church and Sukir, Godric, Eric, Bill, Lorena, and Jason. And my first comment is, oh, Himbo's back and you're gonna be in trouble. I mean, Jason is so incredibly stupid in this. It is.
I love him so much.
It's wonderful.
It's so good. He can't help himself, like, in any way. And he's so malleable at this point in the series. Like, if anybody tells him something, he kind of is like, yeah, that's true, until somebody tells him something else. And I have to say, Anna Camp should have won awards for this role. She is amazing in it. But the entire scene of they've just had sex, which is where we left them at the end of the last episode, and her being like, yeah, I'm going to tell my husband and we're going to be together and it's going to be great. And Jason's like, whoa, like thinking about all those guns in the basement, and also just being like, we just had sex, not, you know, like we didn't, you know, discuss any of this. And so I think it's very, very funny to me, this whole interaction between the two of them.
Yeah, it's truly great. I think with Anna Camp, what's really interesting is the sense you got, particularly in the first couple of episodes with her, that she was the manipulator behind the scenes. And then over the next few episodes, it just becomes that she's smart, but frustrated that she's not getting involved more. And then quite simple and quite innocent in other ways.
I think she wants to be a manipulator. But she's not really.
Yeah, I don't think she's that smart.
Yeah, I think too, and this is like I'm going to talk about this more later. I think this is a very pointed critique of like Southern evangelical like culture. I think Alan Ball, it's like one of the things that he does the best, and whoever he has in his writer's room at this. But one of the things that can be really frustrating for someone like Anna Camp's character is that, like, she is very smart and she is very driven and she does have these ideals, right? Like, she does believe in God. She does believe in all of these things. But no matter how smart and how driven she is, no one is going to take her seriously in this culture because it is so patriarchal based. It is so dismissive of women who try to step out of their role as a wife or a daughter. Or something like that. And so in my mind, the reason why Jason is so attractive to her compared to Steve is because Steve is starting to like go off the deep end in some ways, and he is ignoring her and he is like not listening to her anymore. Jason represents someone who she thinks she can manipulate because he is such a himbo. Jason is someone who will listen to her, and when she says something, he will think about it and he will talk to her about things. He's not like going over her head. And so I think that is why she wants the security of that kind of heterosexual relationship within the structure that she knows, which is this evangelical structure. But she wants somebody that she can control. And Jason, I think for her, represents that in this moment, in this scene.
Yeah. And I think that for all her I think you're absolutely right. For all her manipulations of Steve, she doesn't control him. He makes his own choices and doesn't consult her, and it's not a partnership. There's a great line where she calls Jason a Judas. Jason's response is, "What did Judas do to you?"
Glorious,
such a good delivery from Ryan.
It's so good. I also think that Anna Camp's hair just gets progressively
it's so big
in this scene. Like, I don't know if like between her conversation with Steve and this moment she like went and got a blowout, but like it just gets huge.
I think the blowout might have happened earlier with Jason, but never mind. our cliffhanger was from the last episode was she shot him, and the beginning of this is that he thinks that Jesus saved him, but she's like, it was paintball, you moron.
I also love this thing that happens over the last ep and this one, both in the confrontation he has with Gabe and the confrontation with her, where Jason suddenly has superpowers when Sookie is insulted by someone. Like, he's, like, legitimately, like, afraid. And then she says something very, like, nasty about Sookie. And he's just, like, if there's something's happened to her, I'm going to come back and I won't be coming back with a paintball gun. You know, like, he's very protective about Sookie, but it is also very funny to me that suddenly he just, like, hulks out.
I mean, do we feel like this is the inspiration for John Wick and his dog? Like, is
maybe. he's just, it's very funny to me. I mean, it makes sense for the culture that he's raised in, you know, especially because he's the older brother, you know, like, I have to take care of my little sister, like, but at the same time, it's Jason, like, he's not,
yeah, and he treated her like shit in the last season as well.
Exactly, and so it's just very funny to me that, like, he can be, like, held at knife point and then suddenly, like, take over the entire situation and, like, beat up a ex-military drill instructor or something, you know, like, just because, like, he gets this, like, rage about Sookie. I also think it's very funny, again, both the last episode and this episode, that people keep assuming that they, like, teamed up and neither one of them knows that the other person is there for, like, the majority of the episode.
I mean, I agree, but equally, if I was in the position and I found out, like, why, hang on, his sister is doing this and he seems far too stupid to live, like, I would assume that they would too. I don't think it's an unreasonable assumption.
Yeah. It's just funny to me how ironically wrong it is. Like, like, they just, like, have no communication whatsoever. It's very funny to me.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got half a scene in, so let's crack on. So Godric also gets, we get a little bit more introduced to Godric. Eric also shows up, and Godric says he's going to stay and tells Eric to get Sookie away. I don't really fully understand why Eric can't zoop Sookie away like the way he zooped in, but... Okay, other than
the plot reasons,
other than the episode will be a lot shorter. They have a really interesting exchange. So Sookie's basically, you know, saying, like, he did this, he set her up, he did it for Godric, and he asks her, she asks him if Godric was his maker, and he says, don't use words you don't understand, and then she says, well, do you love him? And he says, don't use words I don't understand.
It's a great dialogue. One of my favorite exchanges of this episode.
Yeah. Truly, truly wonderful.
And I think there's a very... This is the first time we've really seen Eric be vulnerable about anybody or anything. Even with Sookie, who he clearly has developed an obsession with, we haven't seen any vulnerability. It's more, you know, like, I'm just kind of fascinated by this person. With Godric, we see him, like, really, we see kind of, like, the his weak spot, you know, like the softer, like, underbelly, which he doesn't have much of, but we do see it here, and this moment is very well played by Skarsgård, especially when he says, don't use words I don't understand. You know, he gets very, it's like his eyes and his voice just get very soft, and, like, it feels like a denial of something that is true. And I just thought that was just so well done in terms of both the dialogue, but then also the acting kind of showing that the dialogue is a lie.
Yes.
It was very, very well done for me.
Yeah, I agree. It's a line that sounds cool, but the performance is what it makes you realize that it's, that he's, like, pretending, and he does feel that, and it is important to him. It's
I just think that their relationship, he kneels for Godric, like, it's a very again, he's acting in ways that we've never seen him act before.
Yeah it's great.
Speaking of which,
anyway, then there's a bunch of the Church of the Fellowship of the Son of the Children of the Light who are locked down, and he wanders up and pretends to be one of them again. Like, I mean, just knock them all out, like, dude, you could have done that. But what we get as a result is him pretending to be southern and human, and oh gee gosh golly willikers sort of about everything, which again, lots of fun to watch.
It is is very fun. Like you said, I don't understand. Like, he could have gotten her out without hurting anybody, like Godric said. Like, I don't understand it, but we do get this very fun moment for him. And, like, it's completely unbelievable. Like it's not even like he's doing a bad accent necessarily. It's just that he's just such a vampire. Like, he just, like, looks like a vampire that it's just, like, this person is not, like, this is not working for you.
Well, and then he actively tries to glamour one of the people whilst the other three can see him trying to do that.
Yeah.
And so, unsurprisingly, it does not really work. And he ends up having to fight them. And yeah, it's, he then, they then run away, but run into the church when, where Steve is, where loads of other, whatever the bad church people are, and so Eric says he will trade himself for Godric because Steve is any vampire will do for their sun ceremony, meeting the sun ceremony.
Yeah, I actually really thought this was interesting as well from a Godric perspective because we know that, for example, Lorena, that you can be released from your maker, that you don't have to necessarily do everything that they say forever, right? That you can actually be released from it. But Godric at no point during this, even though he tells Eric what to do, he doesn't, like, invoke that magic, right? He doesn't say, as your maker, I command you, or anything like that. So it's unclear whether Eric and Godric still have, like, that particular connection, that magical connection that would make Eric do whatever he wants. And I think that that's really interesting because Godric doesn't feel the need to invoke it. He just knows that Eric will listen to him. And Eric does. I mean, like, it's not really, I mean, part of it is Sookie, I think, but most of it is, like, he doesn't kill, you know, a lot of the people like he could have. You know, he doesn't fight back in the ways that he could, right? He surrenders. He tells Sookie it's going to be okay. He tries to trade himself for Godric and Sookie. Like, it is really interesting that that he obeys Godric without question, without any kind of, like, magical, like, without any kind of magic forcing him to.
I think it's an interesting hierarchy, right? Because what's also clear that is that even if you, as a maker, release your progeny, you are always physically stronger than them, as we saw with Lorena and Bill the other episode. So it's sort of hierarchies of, you know, you can force them just by magic, and then you can give that up, but you can still force them physically. And then, as we see sort of later in the episode, that can also kind of be broken because of, you know, it's never a relationship if that force is applied, in whether it's verbal or physical or anything, right? Else, right.
But, like, there are moments where he could have definitely disobeyed Godric during this episode because Godric, like, wasn't there, and he chooses not to.
He doesn't have to, but he chooses to because of his love for Godric, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is, you know,
honestly,
he does.
This might be the closest maker-makey bond that we have seen. I mean, he and Pam are very close, but I don't think they have this kind of connection between them.
Yeah.
It's different. It's a different kind of closeness.
It's different.
Yeah.
Pam doesn't worship Eric in the same way that Eric worships Godric.
Yes.
I'm not sure that's quite true. I think it's more just a reflection of time, right? Mm-hmm. Pam is clearly a much younger vampire, whereas Eric is basically 1,000 years old and Godric is 2,000 years old. So I think it's just playing off the time between them.
But we can see that also more time can make you, like, I don't think, like, Bill and Lorena could live 2,000 years, and I don't think that they would not hate each other love hate each other. So, like, I do think that's really interesting, all of the different, like, all the different kinds of relationships that we see in this episode between vampires and their makers.
Yeah, 100%. Definitely. It's fun. Okay, so we have a brief interlude where Lorena is holding Barry against the wall because Barry got Professor Xavier'd by Sucker last episode to go
Barry.
And warn Bill.
He just wants to be left alone.
I will say, I can't remember the actor's name, but he looks like a Barry to
me. He does.
Like he really... He does
look like a Barry.
An intense essence of Barry. Anyway, so she feeds on Barry and tastes that he's something different, which sometimes I think you get from other vampires, even just smelling Sookie. They can tell that she's slightly different. So I don't think we've got to the Fae stuff yet, but maybe it's just the psychic stuff. Anyway, he uses the distraction of her feeding on Barry to smash her in the head with a big television.
Twice. Like, he does it twice. It's a very violent moment. We know that it's necessary because of how strong she is. But, like, I was just like, wow, that's that's a lot.
It was a lot, but... it was quite satisfying.
Yeah, no, it was. And especially, like, he throws it down, and, like, you can see, like, the screen just, like, completely dented. It's a very interesting image, for sure. And then he immediately helps Barry leave.
He does, later in the episode, there is a great comment from Lorena, which was like, you think they're flat and quite light, but actually they're really heavy.
They're very, very heavy, yeah. She's like out, like she looks dead, like, and you know obviously that can't kill her, and I do think it's interesting that Bill doesn't kill her, because, you know, she's like incapacitated here.
Well, I think there's still this like fundamental vampire rule, right, which is that you can't kill another vampire, and the last time that Bill did that, there was a problem.
But it is just very interesting to me. But she's very funny later when she talks about the TV.
Yeah. I suspect killing your maker, and maybe this will come up later in the show, but I suspect that is truly a heinous crime in
like
vampire societies.
Like,
it's not like giving Tom Cruise... Lestat dead people with laudanum to feed on.
Although they do get in trouble for that too.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. They do indeed. Right. Anyway, so back at the church, Eric is chained with Silver to the altar.
It
does. It's not
like because of the way their
it's
skin,
not
like
bubbles
and
bubbles and burns. Yeah. It's not the fun kind of being chained to an altar.
No. No. Different chains are requested, please. But Steve says a lot of really like horrible shit, like in this scene. Like he calls Sookie a race traitor and like
didn't she call her the whore of Satan or something?
Yeah, the
like
whore
that
of Satan. Thing. Like it there the metaphor is becoming less metaphorical here. because of the way that he, like, everything he says, you could replace it with, you know, interracial marriage or relationships. Yeah. You could replace it with, you know, queer relationships. You know, this is really great send up of this type of culture. And, like, unfortunately, we've been hearing more of this rhetoric recently. It sort of comes in waves. And so, you know, it's very interesting to hear that here. But it is also interesting that Eric is seems genuinely trying to, like, comfort her
sacrifice
in whatever
himself.
Way he knows how.
Yeah.
He's not great at it. But you know, and she is, you know, trying to also kind of comfort him. They're in this very intimate moment of being surrounded by people who genuinely hate both of them.
Yeah, I mean, Sookie is very Jason in some ways, in that she takes everything at face value. Like she doesn't interrogate very much, which is perhaps what happens when you always know that what someone is actually saying to you, and you just take what they really mean straight away. But yeah, she does. She's a very credulous person in a fun way for a character, albeit a slightly
ridiculous
one.
I think she's also just very empathetic and. I don't mean that necessarily as always a good thing.
No.
Because I think that it causes her to... It almost forces her to identify with people like Eric, who she probably would rather not. Yeah. I think
she
that that's
does.
Part of
she
the
does
other
sort
issue.
Of. Yeah, she defaults into a bit of like both-siderism by default because of her empathy. I agree with you that Alan Ball thinks that subtext is for cowards, and
he really does in so many ways.
Straight up.
I mean, you can replace the word fangers with another word and it would sound like some of the shit that people have said online, like, and so like it is not subtext, it is very much text.
Well, I think there was that initial God Hates Fangs poster in one of the police stations. It's very clear what
it's in the it's in the opening credits too, very briefly. It's one of the images.
Yeah. Well, vampire marriage is like first legalized in Vermont, and like it's very clear what parallels he's driving.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So Bill bursts into the church to say sukkah
every time.
And he's still outnumbered because Eric's like on the altar. Until Jason shoots Steve in the head.
Okay,
with a paintball
I have to gun. Say, everything with Jason in this scene is amazing. Him driving up to the church, first of all, and being like, I was called in by Steve to, like, you know, deal with this situation, and the way that they're, like, suspicious until he shows them the ring, and he's like, honesty, and they're like,
honesty.
Dude, honesty, and like,
honesty, bruh.
Like, it's amazing. It is, again, that send-up of, like, that type of, like, culture, but also kind of the, like, bro, like, you know, culture as well.
Yeah.
I love that as soon as, like, he realizes that the other guy realizes it's a paintball gun, he, like, hits him over the head with it. And you can see that Jason has to take a second to work out that's what he should do. Like, it's just very funny. Like, the acting is great. And then he goes and gets a rifle. The rifle is also paintball. and, like, gets up in the balcony and shoots Steve Doolin in the head with a paintball gun. Like, it's just... Everything about it is great.
It's pretty incredible. And sort of Godric comes into... Oh, no. The Texas vampire, who, like, the cowboy vampire comes in. He's got more vampires. So suddenly we have a lot of vampires. Dan.
Also,
Dan?
Very much a Stan.
Very much. Did you say very much a Stan or very much a Dan?
No, very much a Stan. His name is Stan.
Oh, his name is Stan.
He's very
Sorry.
Much
yeah,
a Stan.
I agree. No, I agree. He's definitely a Stan. He's not a Dan.
On point naming characters.
So it's about, basically the vampires are about to massacre them. And then Godric turns up and stops.
The way this is filmed is very strange to me. I don't know if you noticed it, but like you get the vampire blurring speed of them like attacking or about to attack members of the church, and you see all of these vampires basically, like, you know, they're all kind of about to bite, you know, somebody in the crowd or whatever, but it's also very slow at the same time. Like, it's like they're trying to ratchet up the tension of the moment, like, oh, like something bad is about to happen, but it's like you see like probably 6 or 7 of these shots in a row of these vampires, like, we're gonna watch this one blur over here and attack this person, but no one actually gets bitten. And so it's kind of an odd scene as far as like the way that it's shot.
I mean, it reminded me of X-Men, the like the original Fox movies, with when they're in like a museum and then suddenly Professor X sort of stops time and pauses everything, and like most people are like frozen and not doing anything, and then the mutants are still talking. So Godric has that sort of far, far, far older blood, far, far greater power that allows him to take control of the situation and basically tell everyone, I'm the sheriff of this area. You do what you're told.
Yeah, exactly. And if, you know, again, with the subtext being for cowards, he does this as he's standing literally like in front of a cross, like, at, you know, at the top of the church, you know, very, very like either godlike or saint-like or whatever you want to like make that parallel.
Yes, he speaks to Steve and says that I am older than your Jesus, but I never met him.
But he's like genuinely sad about it.
It reminds me of the scene in season 2 of Buffy where there's a vampire going, I was at the crucifixion. And Spike is like, please, if every vampire was at the crucifixion that says they were at the crucifixion, it would have been all vampires. I was at Woodstock. I fed on a hippie.
Yes, I do remember that scene. That is pretty great. Godric is a very serene character as well. He's very philosophical. But what I think it's interesting that he's very, the way he looks and the way that he was sort of introduced in the last episode when we get the flashback to Eric being made, he's very young looking. And to me, that kind of gives me, especially in that first flashback, it gives me real Peter Pan vibes, like, you know, this person who's like a child forever and he just wants to play and, you know, all of that kind of thing. But then when we see this version of Godric, he seems old.
And
it's not communicated through anything but just his serenity, like this idea that like anything that happens, he's seen it before, it doesn't really upset him. There's sort of this just sort of calm about him in every situation.
Yeah, I don't think he has the sort of innocence and naivety of Peter Pan. I think he, you know, he wants peace, but he's not naive about it. He's sort of optimistic rather than cynical.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I agree. I mean, he is young, and I think both him and Steve have kind of a similar sort of youthful look to them.
Mm-hmm.
As sort of different sides of the coin, and like there's later times when Godric is like, you know, this was inevitable because we never evolved, we never changed from being bloodthirsty killers. The church was inevitable to happen.
Yeah, I really am interested in Godric as a character, and I would be very interested in talking to Elise or Melissa, who couldn't be on this episode, about how they talk about him in the books, because he's like one of the characters that I actually would be very interested in knowing how he became a vampire, and knowing kind of like what his whole situation is. I love his tattoos. I love that you can see like, you know, peaks of them, you know, even when he's wearing a very modern looking shirt, he still has this very like ancient feel about him, almost like modernity doesn't fit him very well, because he kind of almost seems like he belongs in a time that's past, which is a very hard thing to pull off, I think. But I think both the acting and the way that he's shot, the way that he's dressed, works very well for him. I am also fascinated by vampires who are children or who look physically young. Like, I love Claudia in Interview with the Vampire. There is a great character, Melissa would know this, with the Anita Blake series. I'm trying to remember the name of the first Guilty Pleasures book. But she's the villain, and her name is Nicholas. And she's also a child who is a vampire. She's like the oldest one there, but she's like physically a child. And Godric is obviously older than that, but he still just has this very, like, I'm just very interested in like, because everyone else seems older than him, like physically older than him. There's sort of this contrast between his age and his youth as well.
Yeah, and that sort of concept of the too old in a child's body is, you know, it's in June as well. Mm-hmm. It sort of permeates.
It's in the Eternals
science
as
fiction
well.
And fantasy. It's in the Eternals, with Sprite. It is a common theme, and it's a common frustration, right? Like the scene in Interview with the Vampire where she cuts her hair and then wakes up and it's grown back is really, like, to me, one of the most important scenes in that movie, because it makes you realize what a crime they committed in turning her child.
That's also in, I mean, these are very silly books, but it's also an issue in the Twilight books as well, because it is actually a crime. It's like one of the few crimes they have in their society to turn a child. And they almost get in trouble because Bella and Edward's child looks like they turned a child into a vampire. And so it's very interesting. It's always interesting to me, like, these issues when they get brought up. But yeah, like, Godric also has, like, this feel about him where he's too old. It almost feels like people shouldn't live that long. there's something, like, and I don't mean that in, like, a negative way. He seems actually like a very decent person, at least at this point in his life. But he seems tired.
I think tired is right.
Yeah.
Spread over too much, too little butter spread over too much bread.
That is really the vibe that you get from him as well.
Yeah, it's a really good performance, and I agree. Like, I'd love to know more about Godric and where he came from, and he's sort of implicitly kind of Saxon, in that, like, he's speaking German, not Swedish or any of those languages, or any Norse language to Eric in flashback. But Eric, we know, is more of a Viking heritage, so you kind of like. And as you said, he's 2,000 years old, so he's sort of a Germanic tribe or something. Anyway.
I'd love to see more of the tattoos as well. I think you see them a little bit in the flashback more. But yeah.
In a show that is not short in showing us chests. And,
I know.
It's very disappointing.
Although, we'll talk about this a little bit later when we get to Jessica and, you know, things that grow back with vampires. He would have had to have been tattooed before he became a vampire.
Yeah.
And so, again, that makes me wonder, how young was he when he got these tattoos? You know what I mean? Like, there are all sorts of questions that sort of come up with the character design.
Yeah, I guess my guess is in the Southern Vampire Mysteries, they'd just be like, don't worry about it.
Don't. You're asking sometimes too many questions. He's hot,
I haven't read the books. Jessica is not a character in the books, right? She's
whole cloth for the show. I have not read them either.
Yeah. So therefore, I wonder whether this will maybe let's park there and get that conversation when we get to the Jessica storyline, because I wonder if actually what happens to her isn't that in keeping with what happens to vampires in the books, and whether it is actually like a show invention and therefore sits with some problems in the writers and the showrunners.
But it's not an uncommon theme in vampire fiction either. So yeah, but that is really interesting to me.
No, it's the same as the problem with Kirsten Dunst in Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah.
Right, okay, what else have we got? Anyway, Jason can't hold off one parting shot when they all depart from...
It might be my favorite thing that he says in this episode. I reckon I've already been to heaven. It was inside your wife. Jason, what a slut. Like, he's just... Jason the Slut is back, and I'm so happy.
Jason, I'm very much a fan of Jason the Slut. I don't think that Steve Newland has been inside his wife for quite some time.
I think that is absolutely right. I think part of her problem was sexual repression. So,
yes.
Yes. Very much so. Anyway,
they all go back to Godric's sort of mansion and have like a party, like a soiree, like a intimate drinks and nibbles. It's so weird.
I do vampires just have the makings to throw a party together at any given moment? Like, is it just like... Sure.
Yes, and unlike Marianne, they don't pretend that a wedding cake is a birthday cake.
They're just like, we're here, everybody survived, Godric's back, let's have a party. Also, it's so weird, because it's not a, like, it's such a, like, professional drinks mixer type of party, yeah. Too. It's not like a... like a wild ranger.
It's a networking event, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. And I'm like, who the fuck is Jason talking to? He knows a total of two people here, and it's Sookie and Bill. So, like, you see him in these moments just, like, talking to random people, like, in the background, and I'm just like, what is happening here?
Well, random people. He's talking to women. He's always talking
true.
To women. Right?
That's true. He does have a conversation with Godric that is kind of excellent, actually. Mm. I did like the way that he tells Godric that he's sorry, and that he legitimately did not know, like, that he was there. But then also, you know, he has to also reckon with, like you said, with the fact that he was part of this group, and he does take some accountability here in terms of, you know, like, they, you know, they made me think this way, but he's not, like, pushing it off on them. It seems like a fairly genuinely apology from Jason here. And I don't know if that's because Godric is who he is or Jason is who he is, but it is a very interesting moment. And then, of course, Eric has to be like, you know, we know that you've been doing V. And, like, you know, they kind of, he's like, we'll call it even, you know, but it is a very interesting exchange.
Yeah, I think Jason, as usual, is very genuine in the moment, but none of that presupposes the fact that he couldn't, like, talk to another preacher and get his head turned back in 5 minutes' time. Like, he's not... I mean, my problem with Jason being in this plot the whole time was always, like, it just didn't make any sense to me that he would go from... His arc didn't make sense to me, that he goes from, you know, genuine sympathy for Eddie into this church... where the only reason they exist is to hate vampires. Like, they don't talk about anything else. It's all, they're training to kill vampires. Like, and it's, I can believe he's manipulated, but it's just like, it's a bit, I don't know. I've always found that frustrating about,
and
it means that we get some fun scenes.
Against them, yeah. But then he, like, will be like, oh, okay. Like,
but he's
like,
still credulous about it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I think thematically it works for the season, because the season is so much about, like, people being gaslit and people, although Marianne's much better at it than the church is.
Yeah.
But you're right. It doesn't actually make sense that Jason would have stuck around for so long. He did say, though, that they made him feel special, which I think Jason needs to feel special, and so there could be a little bit of that in there. Like, he wanted to feel like he belongs.
The quarterback.
Like, yeah, and so, like,
he wants to be the quarterback, right?
Yeah,
he wants to be the high school star.
Yeah, and so I think that is a big draw for him. But you're right. No matter how stupid Jason is, it does seem a little odd that he would stick around quite that long. I still like that he apologized to Godric. He didn't have to. But I like that he does sort of take that accountability.
Yeah, he goes during this whole mixer, and I am calling it a mixer because that's how it feels.
It feels so cold.
So weirdly, yeah, weirdly, particularly for vampires, it just feels it's very much a network event. Bill and Sookie have been, like, avoiding talking about Lorena, or Bill has been avoiding talking about Lorena, telling Sookie exactly what happened, and they get interrupted multiple times, basically to set up the scenario where Lorena comes in whilst Bill is off talking to Jason, because Jason insists he has to talk to him right now for something super urgent, which is just Jason going, yeah, I'm sorry about everything.
Which, again, I appreciate it. I don't know why it was
again,
so urgent.
It's a good thing, but like, it wasn't that urgent. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was urgent because it had to get Bill out of there so that Lorena could come in and try and, I don't know, try and dom Sookie, basically.
Wearing like, a magnificent dress. Like,
incredible dress.
I will say,
dress.
The cool part about this, like, weird mixer vibe is that everyone's wearing, like, black and white, and she comes in this, like, just crimson dress, you know, just, like, gorgeous, gorgeous dress with her hair, like, her hair is curled on top. It looks very like old Hollywood starlet kind of vibe, and nobody else looks like that in the room. It's very, very striking. Like your eye is just drawn to her.
Yeah. She looks incredible, but she is very petty. And I did really appreciate how this scene played out, because there's very few things more tedious in TV than like characters withholding something from someone else for no reason other than the plot needs them to, and then them being angry with each other because one withholds something from the other.
It's bad writing, but they're in like, my opinion. When
it's really
happens.
Yeah.
It's I like agree. You couldn't figure out a but different this, way to have conflict, but
But in this case, like, it's set up exactly that way, and then it just doesn't play out that way because she tries to push on Sookie. Bill is immediately like, no, that's she held me. Mm-hmm. Sookie's like, oh, so this is your maker, and you know, puts the dots together in her head, and then immediately it's just like, you can't do anything. You've already lost. You look desperate. In fact, showing up here looking like that is probably a sign of how desperate you are. And I'm not prepared to take any shit from you. And in classic Sookie way, not aware that she's like in the presence of a very old vampire in a house full of vampires who could very easily kill her.
I love Sookie. She has no regard for danger at all. Like, when she gets upset, she's just like... Bill is holding her back, like, from Lorena. Yeah. He's not holding Lorena back. And it's just, it's a, like, very funny image to me. I think he even tells her, like, just be careful. And, like, she's just like, no, like, this is my man. Like, I'm not taking shit from her.
It's great. Anyway, so at some point, like, Bill just gets pushed away and Lorena is about to bite Sookie, and basically Godric just comes in and like goes, nope.
Vampires are very into choking, I've noticed over the last couple of episodes. There's a lot of choking happening. I'm not saying it's a bad kink. I'm just saying it's definitely a vampire kink.
It's not the worst representation of kink that happens in this episode, which has multiple representations of kink.
It does. It really does. And I always love a good scene where, like, the, you know, to quote the classic Star Wars, there's always a bigger fish, from probably one of the worst Star Wars movies. But I enjoy a scene where somebody thinks that they're the most powerful in the room and they're just, like, not by a long way. And that's kind of what happens in this moment with Godric. Because Godric, again, you know, is the most powerful vampire here. And sometimes I think Eric might be the only one who remembers that at times. And we get to see, like, an actual example of it here, of him being, like, just, like, so powerful and so strong. But I also think that she really proves his point. You know, because he basically tells Eric, like, we've been around for so long and we haven't evolved. And it makes me feel like it made me feel like, this is a weird tangent, but my brain immediately thought of sharks, you know, like this idea that they stopped evolving because they've sort of reached the apex of like where that particular evolutionary tree can go. And so Godric is basically like, no, we became top of the food chain and then we had no incentive to change or to grow or to become better. And I really like that Lorena is kind of the embodiment of his point, because like she, like you said, she's so petty, but she's so old. Yeah. And like, what's the point of all that power and time if you don't like become better? You know, she's the same person that she was in the flashbacks that we saw. And that was, you know, 70 years ago or whatever. And so like the idea that she spends her time trying to get into these like bitchy fights with her ex's girlfriend, you know, like it just like so accurately demonstrates what he's trying to say. about vampires.
Yeah, he's wonderfully dismissive of her. He's also like, I don't know who you are.
Yeah. I love how he turns to Bill and he's like, you seem to know her.
Well, he's like, I can tell that you're old and haven't done anything.
Yeah.
Like, what's the point of you? Like, I mean, the pedantic scientist in me is like, it's not evolution. Evolution takes place over millions of years.
Right.
It's
change and learning. Evolution.
But it's like, yeah. it's growth, right? It's change, it's learning, it's development. And he's absolutely right. Like, she's... And it's why Bill doesn't like her either, right? Like, Bill is a very conflicted character that anyone can like or dislike in multiple different ways. But what he does want to do is, and even if he's old-fashioned, quote-unquote, he does want to change. He does want to do things differently. He does want to learn. He's not comfortable just sitting where he is. Whereas Lorena is just like, whatever hedonism she did, however many years she was in the hut in the woods that she like lured soldiers to and killed them, and then whatever hedonism she had from just touring around with Bill, like she can't do that change herself. She has to take it from other people. And yeah, as you say, she's just getting into petty bitch fights with a human.
Yeah, like someone who doesn't love her. Like, you know, like she hasn't gotten over it, you know? And like, it is interesting to me, especially because so much emphasis over the last, you know, season, almost two seasons, about vampires has been like, you can't, you know, they're very territorial and you can't do this and you can't do that. And like, it just seems so animalistic in some ways, you know, and so petty and so like, you disrespected me, so I get to like drink your blood or, you know, like whatever. Yeah. And I like that Godric is like, why? Like, you know, like this just seems so pointless. You know, like, why do we have to be this way? And he is it is interesting the way that he says, like, you know, they're not right, they're hateful, but, you know, they're reacting to us. You know, they are, you know, reacting to something that we are doing that is very threatening. And, you know, I did genuinely appreciate that.
Yeah, I guess he's the difference between empathy and understanding, right? Like, he's not empathetic to their position, but he is understanding of it. And he's got this, as you say, this serenity about him, this sort of way he moves through the world. And it's thoughtful in a way that you look at Lorena and like, you've never thought about anything. You're pure, you know, it's
I don't
ego
know if she would ever
stuff,
become
right?
Like
it's pure.
Like,
no.
Like, I just don't think she's ever, like you said, I don't think she's ever thought about it. Like, there's no self, there's no introspection, no self critique.
No.
Like, at all.
No. And she's stuck in this. So Bill walks her out the house because Godric was like, you seem to know who this person
he
is.
He does not care. Like, he's just like, you are harsh in the mellow, dude.
Godric barely knows or cares who Bill is,
yeah,
right?
True. Like,
Godric cares about Eric, Jason, and Suki. Those are basically slightly Bill, right?
But so, only like and, only in relation to Suki and Eric. Like, it's just like you're Suki's friend.
But I think it's also an interesting parallel, right? Like, because they also bring in the other Texas senior vampire, Eurotrash lady, whatever her name is, and her human lover who had betrayed
Bianca?
Them.
Is that her name?
And that seems like a credible name for her. You know, and Godric asks her if she loves the human, even though he betrayed them. And she's honest about it, right? Like, she's not trying to deny it. She's not trying to excuse it. She's just like, you're in charge, but yeah, this is how I feel. And he lets the human go. To the disgrace, to the, you know, disgust of Stan the cowboy vampire. Whereas I think it's a really interesting comparison with how he reacts with Lorena, where he's like, you're just, you can't be honest with yourself. You're not learning. You're not doing anything. You're banished from Texas, basically, or at least that part of Texas, right?
Yeah, I also think, too, there's this, there is this also contrast in age, right? Like, there's this idea that, like, they've only lived X amount of years, right? It, like, human lifespans to him has to feel like a blip, right? Like, it has to feel like just nothing to him. Whereas someone like Lorena, it's almost like the disappointment is compounded because she is so old, you know, because he's like, you've had time. You could have learned. You could have used it for something. Like, I don't think he's excusing the humans, but it's almost like they get off because they don't live very long for him. You know, like, they don't, you know, have time to think about these things as much, which I think is an interesting perspective.
Yeah, and it does make such a difference, like the contemplation of immortality, mm-hmm. right? And he, that's what he's doing. That's what he is in this episode, is he's contemplative of what it means to be given this kind of gift from his perspective of immortality, and therefore it matters what you do with that. And I think it's a very interesting comparison with the likes of Buffy and even the Interview with the Vampire series, where vampirism is a form of a demon inside you, mm-hmm. and the vampires, as far as I can tell in this show, again, I've only seen the TV, I've not read the books, but they're not demons.
No,
they're not good, but they're not like, it's almost like by saying like a vampire has a demon inside them, it's an excuse to not sort of have introspection on, you know, what it means to be immortal.
Well, it's power, right? Like, they're doing things that they probably would have done as humans if they could get away with it, right? And so there is sort of that aspect of it.
And Jessica is actually a perfect example of that, mm-hmm. right?
I think, like, she even says that, right? Like, if I would totally been a slut if I could have got away with it. She says that, like, in the last episode.
she does.
Yeah, great, and I feel like that's kind of the point of view of most vampires. Like, we have the power, so why would we, like, we can't be held accountable, you know, for what we do. So why would we restrain ourselves? I will also say, before we kind of move, you know, into the next really plot line of this, that what he is saying seems very, it does disgust a lot of the vampires. I think it disturbs Eric, because Eric has been operating on that, like, I'm powerful, so I can do what I want, of vibe for a long time. And you get the impression that he learned that from Godric. And so, like, to see Godric, you know, sort of reach this stage of his life where he's, like, looking back and having this introspection and saying, like, maybe we're wrong. Maybe we should be doing things differently. I think that that does, it causes Eric to have a bit of an existential, like, crisis. We don't really see it in this episode, but you can tell the look on his face is very, like, what is happening? Like, I feel like the rug is being pulled out from under me in terms of who this person is and how much I've based my life on, you know, what this person taught me and my relationship with this person.
Yeah, I think it's interesting compared to, say, how, so Stan basically is just appalled by it, mm-hmm. but can't do anything about it because of power. Eric is reflective on it. Mm-hmm. I think he doesn't view it as a challenge. He just doesn't understand it
because he respects Godric so much and he loves him, you know.
He loves him,
so it, you know, it doesn't disgust him because he can't imagine that this person would hold a position that would be wrong, you know,
or at least that isn't worth thinking about.
Exactly And I think that's important for Eric's development as a character.
Right, we should probably wrap up an hour
into this podcast. We should probably
wrap up the first plot line. And the very end of the episode is Luke showing up at the party. Who let Luke in? I don't know who let Luke in. This makes no sense. He just showed up. There was no of the many vampires. There's no silver detectors. There's no, like, whatever. Okay, anyway, so Luke shows up. he basically says, Steve Newland sent me, and he has a suicide vest with a grenade and a time bomb. Hey, that's the name of the episode.
It is the name of the episode.
And a bunch of, like, silver chains and stuff attached to him, and presses the button, and that's our cliffhanger. So do we want to do cliffhanger now, and then we can jump back into the
other
plot?
Sounds good to me. I think as I was reviewing the cliffhangers spreadsheet that we have, love a spreadsheet in this podcast.
We have spreadsheets for
everything. Which is great. I would put this actually pretty high. I would put it up around 5 or 6, I think. I definitely think it's lower on the list than Daphne puts the bullhead on Marianne and Sam screams, just because that's such a weird cliffhanger that I just kind of love it. Like, you know, like the imagery of that cliffhanger is just so strange. But I do think that because so many characters are, like, legitimately in peril because of this cliffhanger, because it's hard to imagine, like, oh my god, like, how are the vampires going to survive this? You know, because Silver is so, like, deadly slash painful to them. That, to me, I think puts it pretty high on the list, personally.
So I think my only comparison is that right at the end of the last episode, we also got Jason being shot and he wasn't dead. And we've also got this episode, Steve being shot and he wasn't dead. Mm-hmm. And we don't actually see anyone die. So that's why I might put it just below Dawn is dead. So
I'm willing to accept
at the
that.
End of episode 103, which is our number 7, Dawn actually being dead. This is like, we haven't actually seen anyone die, and we've been given a number of, like, fake outs where anyone actually dies recently. So my suggestion is this would be our new number 8, ahead of There Are Four Coffins, but below Dawn is Dead.
I'm willing to accept that. I'm good with that. It's funny because, like you said, Alan Ball feels like subtext is for cowards, but I also feel like there is nothing that he's not willing to load with metaphor as well. Because of the whole time bomb, like, ending of this, like, there's a literal time bomb in this, but it also sort of represents how everything is simmering in this episode, right? Everything is sort of building, not just to this point, but then to, like, even the other plot lines feel like there are time bombs in them as well, which we can get to.
Yeah, the episode, in fact, closes with Time Bomb by Beck, and I'm just frankly disappointed it didn't end with Time Bomb by Rancid, which is a far superior song.
You know, can't win them all. Can't win them all. This episode, or this series, does such a good job with music, but...
It does. It really does. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. New number 8.
All right.
New number 8.
Lonzie and Tessa. Sweet. Right. We should crack on.
Let's go back to Bon Tom.
That gives us... Back to Bon Tom. Right. Okay. I think I'm going to make this mostly Marianne. I was going to say Lafayette, but I don't think Lafayette's in this
episode, actually.
Or if he is, he's very briefly. Yeah. Marianne, Tara, Sam, and Eggs. So Eggs sort of turns up at Merlot's and is very distressed and distracted because he feels like he's missed time from... recently and he in fact has, because he was blacked out killing Daphne, and so him and Tara just sort of are quite concerned, and they sort of go back to the house, and Marianne is sauteing some veg and just being very homely, and she says, oh, you know, you've just been partying a bit too hard, must be the reason. So they go upstairs.
Is this also the episode? I watched the last two together. Is this the episode where Arlene tells Tara that she also blacked out, and she thinks that she...
That was last episode.
Okay, that was last. Okay, never
mind. They raped Tara, okay. Yeah. So she last episode she says, you know, she's been wanting to have sex with Terry. He's been a bit unsure because of obvious Terry reasons.
Right.
And they got a bit blacked out, and then there were signs.
The point
basically.
Is that Tara is very concerned in a way that nobody else seems to be about the fact that people keep blacking out. I keep thinking about how upset that this makes her because of her mom, probably. Because she, I don't think she actually compares it to her mom, at least not in this episode, but it's kind of there, right? Like this idea of like, people are losing time. I'm losing time. My boyfriend is losing time. This is like bringing up some childhood trauma, which I think is why Marianne is kind of like, maybe we should ease off on the partying. I don't actually believe Marianne wants to ease up on the partying, but I think she says that just to calm Tara down.
No, she's saying it because she is manipulating Tara.
Yeah. There's right? so like
she's
much gaslighting this episode.
What she thinks Tara wants to I mean, and has been, right, ever since Marianne showed up, right? Like, she wants Tara at her most vulnerable so that she can take advantage of her and chop up Daphne's heart. Because Daphne was in Sam's freezer at Malotte's, with a big hole in her chest, and what we see is a fully, you know, bloody heart being sliced up by Marianne, fried with the vegetables, and put into what she calls a hunter's souffle.
So this reminded me of the show Hannibal quite a bit. Except for the show Hannibal, did you watch Hannibal at all?
I've seen bits of Hannibal. I believe it's as gay as this show.
Yes. Absolutely, maybe more in some ways. But that show is so well known for the fact that like there are so many scenes of him like making food, and it's very pretty the way that he makes food, but then there'll be like an organ that he's using, or like something that's like very obviously like human, but it's like very pretty. Like it makes you like hungry, and then that kind of like disgusts you because it like makes you like want to eat what he's making because it looks so good. This scene reminded me of that quite a bit, because the pie that she makes actually seems very appetizing, but that scene of her slicing up the heart is it's a lot. And this meal did win a Scream Award for most memorable mutilation, this like specific scene of her making the meal, which I think is very fascinating.
I'm going to play an audience surrogate and say, what's a Scream Award?
Oh, it's like a horror awards, for horror. This show has some traditional horror.
Is it like a teen's choice award where you get gunked?
Like
in this case, you get like carry blood on your head when you win.
I wish that would be amazing. This show dabbles in horror quite a bit, but the horror that it dabbles in is mostly monster horror. This definitely feels more like body horror. It feels a lot more like a cannibal type of, I mean, and that's what it is, type of horror. It's dipping its toe into something else here.
I think it's interesting because we've seen Miss Jeanette dead with her heart ripped out, but it's been a little bit sort of covered up. We've obviously seen the scratches on Sookie's back. We've seen the scratches on Daphne's back. Seeing Daphne in the freezer with a hole where her heart should be. And then I think it's pretty much the next scene, or if it's not the next scene, it's one after that. Seeing Marianne genuinely chopping up a heart is like
slicing humming and sauteing it with the vegetables. Like it is very disturbing. Did eggs kill
Daphne?
No, he killed Daphne. Did he kill Miss Jeanette?
If he did, we didn't see it, unless that
I know we didn't see it, but I'm curious if, like, when he went into the woods and they saw, like, the bloody stone and everything.
Yeah.
Like, does he remember that because that was where he killed her?
I got the impression, and I could be wrong, that that was the place of the last blood sacrifice orgy that Marianne had.
Gotcha.
Which was, like, because they were driving quite a while away to pick up the guy who would fix the boiler or whatever, right? And the intention was that they were going to sacrifice Sam. That was what I read.
Right.
Was like,
I'm just
the plan
curious,
was to sacrifice Sam.
I'm just curious how many times she's made eggs do this.
Yeah.
Like, that was kind of what
multiple
I thought.
Times.
And that that made me almost feel like he's literally his trauma, his PTSD is literally trying to like surface, you know, in his brain. Yeah. But he can't remember any of it. That was what this made me think of, was like how many times his eggs had to do this for her.
Yeah, and I think the creepiness and the horror of this season is the gaslighting of Marianne, but the fact that it's gaslighting in such a, you know, monstrous way, mm-hmm. right? Like that it involves feeding someone their heart, someone else, their friend's heart, mm-hmm. right? Someone that she worked with.
It's very
someone that the ex was friends with.
It's almost very like Titus Andronicus, except for the whole like they're not literally feeding his sons to him, but like it's still like here's a pie with like, and you're like unaware of what
yeah,
you're
or
eating.
The phrase in Game of Thrones when she feeds she feeds them all to each other, right?
Yeah.
So it is. This is what I remember. I was listening to randomly a few weeks ago. I was listening to some of late last season when Marianne got introduced, when we were talking about it, and I was like, I remember Marianne. She was the scariest villain. And like, this is what I remember. It's this body horror with the heart and the fact that they're starting to realize something's wrong, but then she sort of hooks them back in with, you know, with magic, right? Like with this cooked up heart, with this sort of pagan sacrifice. And then the result of it is them, and it is initially kind of funny because they're giggling and getting high. And then they start slapping each other in a way that's kind of funny at first, because sort of Tara's doing to Egg, so it's all subverting things. And then he's like, she knees him hard, and it's still sort of kind of
like they're
funny,
both,
but it's
like,
sort
giggling,
of getting dark.
Yeah,
they're both giggling, and he's like, that was good. And then he absolutely sort of slaps her around the face, and it starts getting really uncomfortable. And then they, you know, they're sort of black-eyed fighting and fucking, and it's fucking creepy.
Yeah,
like,
it is, because in a way, know in that a way, they have like no agency over this. In a
control,
way, she's using them to violate each other.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't have any kind of, like, I don't get the sense that either of them, this is not shaming anyone whose kink this is. I don't get the sense this is normal. This would be normal in their, in the way that they interact with each other sexually. They don't seem like the kind of people that get off on slapping each other. Especially not like this.
No, and particularly Tara, I think just, it's absolutely not the vibe, and it's non-consensual, right?
Yeah.
That's the violation, is the non-consent.
Right, this is Marianne's kink. This isn't their kink.
Yes.
Yeah. And so that, her just like laughing and smiling, you know, like while it's happening is just so, it's so disturbing. It does definitely fit into that idea, because we found out by now that she's a Maenad. It does fit into that sort of mythological version of the Maenad, who is, you know, it's not just sexual pleasure or getting drunk. There's also this like undercurrent of violence and like out of control ness to it. So it fits who she is mythologically, but it is disturbing as fuck. Like, it is very messed up what's happening here. And that's all we see, which is like, you know, there's no resolution of this in this episode either.
No. And it's sort of weirdly interspersed with, like, there's a number of scenes it's interspersed with sort of the soiree in Dallas at Godric's place. So, yeah, this is rough stuff, mm-hmm. but, you know, pretty good writing again, like, really, Michelle Forbes' ability to start off being charming, but you know there's something wrong. And then just every episode, like, is 3% more creepy.
And more out of control. Because at first it's just like, we're going to get high and we're going to like have, you know, like we're going to have fun. Yeah. And yeah, maybe it's a little crazy, but it's not, you know, like, you know, it's just
maybe
like
we don't remember exactly what happened, but it's just an orgy. That's
like
fun,
this,
right?
Yeah. Like, you know, like, and it happens so slowly over time that you could see where Tara would get to the point where she's like, how did I even get here? You know, like, it's almost like she doesn't notice it because it's just so slow and so like
insidious.
Absolutely.
Okay. Anything else we want to talk about them? Other than the Hunter souffle.
It does look really good, I have to say. As someone who enjoys a good pastry crust over savory things, I do enjoy that. And so that almost made it worse for me because I was just like, this does look good. And like, I'm horrified by how much I like the way this looks. Yeah.
This will be Tessa's entry for Great British Bake Off, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, it definitely gave me very Hannibal vibes. In this particular section.
And I assume Hunter in this case is sort of Dionysus sort of referencing.
Yeah.
Artemis. And is it Artemis or Dionysus? I'm not like,
Dionysus is the god that the Maenads serve. Yeah. And she almost looks very Maenad like when she comes in. We didn't talk about this and it's so brief, but when she comes in and she's like in the blue dress and her hair is wild and she's holding the rabbit and dripping blood. Like it's like perfect image of that, like the handmaiden, you know, that, you know, is sort of, you know, part of this.
So I think that was last episode, to be fair,
was it?
But I think you're right. Yeah. Cause I think Tara is like, did you sleep outside or something?
Yeah. But she tells them it's the rabbit.
She sleeps outside.
That's in the pie.
She sleeps outside and like, is carrying a rabbit and Tara's like, is there that rabbit that you killed in here? And she's like, amongst other things, like amongst Daphne's heart.
So creepy.
All right. Sam, Daphne and Andy. So as I said, sort of the beginning of the episode, we've got Sam gets a very quick call from Marianne and sort of warning him to go into his restaurant where he finds Daphne heartless in a freezer. Sam is basically just about to call the cops when they turn up anyway because they got tipped off by Marianne because she's trying to fuck with him. Bud and Kenya are interviewing Sam about this. Sam is like, it wasn't me. They're like saying, well, there's a lot of people died around you, and he's like, you know that was Renee. Like, what? You can't pin that on me. You know that was him.
I do have to say, there, as of evidence, is very circumstantial. There isn't really any like physical evidence linking him to any of this. So it does feel like the arrest that they make is unethical and would get tossed out in a courtroom. But you know, whatever. This show is not concerned with with making that, you know, realistic. I did really enjoy Andy coming in and trying to help Sam, but of course he tries to help him in the worst way possible by telling them all of the stuff that happened, and it just sounds like he was incredibly drunk, which to be fair he was. I did love him pointing at his broken arm and being like, war wound. And Sam just being like, if I told you that's what happened, would you believe me?
Knows that this is not helpful.
This is not helping me.
It was pretty good.
I didn't realize that the black officer's name is Kenya until just like this episode. It kind of feels extremely J.K. Rowling level of racist naming, to be honest to me, like to call the black officer Kenya. It kind of feels like some of the ways in which she names her characters things that feel very stereotypical, like the Irish naming conventions, for an example. That's like a pet peeve of mine. I don't know if that's in the book or not, but anyway.
Yeah, I don't know either. I know, like, because I know a sort of bunch of sort of black British people who were named London because they were born in London. So I don't, like, it didn't bump on me.
I think it's just because it's the name of an African country. It's like, she's black, like Africa. Yeah. You know, that's just the thing that bothered me about it. I do like her as a character. She seems like a very interesting counterpoint to Bud.
Yes, but, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. But they, anyway, he does arrest Sam, takes him into the jail. He gets his own jail cell, which is kind of Bud, because in the other jail cell is all of the horny people who basically got arrested for indecency after the last orgy, or in Coroner Mike's case, was arrested for sodomy with a pine tree. So, Tessa, as the expert, what part of a tree is the ass?
As the expert on tree fucking? I don't think this is technically sodomy, because I don't think that you can sodomize a tree just on the basic, like, atomical level. I assume there was some kind of hole. I don't know. I feel awful for Mike, by the way, because, like, that's gotta hurt. Like, the next day, like, there's probably splinters and stuff. Like, I don't...
Well, he literally says there are splinters in his pecker. Because, this is my... Okay, I'm going to take a very, very factual concern with this Alan Ball. I believe that you, Alan Ball, are aware of what sodomy
is. Oh, yeah. No, I think this is a joke. I think the whole point is that they don't know what to, like, call why they arrested him. And so they just, like, slapped sodomy on it. But, like, yeah.
It's just a Southern thing, right? Like... Yeah. Because I'm like, look... Either sodomy is anal sex.
Yeah.
So either a tree has an ass, or Mike was sodomizing himself with a tree.
Oh. And... I didn't think about that. But no, but he talks about his dick, though.
He talks about...
Yeah.
Yeah, he does talk about his dick. So, yeah.
That's why I was thinking that he was fucking the tree. Maybe both.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
Maybe both. Maybe they got him on a technicality.
Maybe. That is interesting. Yeah, because, like, but also, even if, yeah, maybe he was sodomizing himself. Because I was going to say, if you were fucking a tree, I don't think that could be considered sodomy anyway, because, one, it doesn't have an ass, but two, like, it's an inanimate object. So, like, that would open a lot of doors about, like, sex toys and stuff that I'm, like, not, like interested in really, like, going down that rabbit hole. Anyway.
Okay. We're getting quite late into the podcast, so this is where I'm going to start saying things like, so that's why the Ents can't reproduce because of pine trees.
I do feel bad for Bud, I will say, in this scene. This seems like a lot to deal with for, like, a very, like, small sheriff's department. I feel like he's just doing the best that he can. But these people, I do also feel bad for these people, because, like Tara, like, it is funny, but like Tara and Eggs, like, I don't feel like they consented to any of this. And, like, these are things that they would not normally do. And so, like, I do feel bad for everyone in this situation, everyone in this jail right now.
I feel bad, but I laugh at this one, whereas I feel bad and I'm, like, really uncomfortable with the Tarex.
Absolutely.
All right. Shall we move on? Shall we have a palate cleanser
then? Yes, Jessica and Hoyt, my favorite couple. I love them.
Yeah. So Bill walks in on them in the middle of fucking... So.
Oh my god, is this like the second or third time? Like, it is becoming a thing this season, Bill walking in on Jessica doing something sexual, specifically something sexual with Hoyt.
Yeah, well, he also walks in on Jessica when she ordered a human to the room to drink their blood.
That's
as
right.
Well,
so, yeah. He's, oh my god,
this is the point
Sookie
where he's like,
and like Sookie's like, what am I supposed to do? Like, yeah, it's,
I mean, Sookie is clearly shipping it to be fair, so
yeah, this time though he's just like, whatever, like, just take her home, I cannot deal with this right now.
It's like, I've got other shit to deal with. In fact, seeing as I clearly can't stop this, please get her the fuck out of here as quickly as you can. Get, and again, this goes back to the fact that he gets Hoyt to drive her home overnight before dawn, which goes back to the fact of, why did they fly from
I don't understand how time works in this show or space sometimes. Because, like, even Godric is like, you need to leave, like, to Lorena. He's like, you need to, like, get out of my territory before the sun comes up. I'm like, how long does she have? Like, you know, like, I don't believe he cares. But it did make me think about Hoyt and Jessica, where I'm just like, when did this night start? How long, how many hours are in this night? Like, it just feels like a lot happens.
So, as someone who lives in Northern Europe, which is a relatively high latitude, and as someone who's also been to Norway and near the Arctic Circle, which can have extraordinarily long days,
Texas,
and extraordinarily
though.
Long
Texas,
nights.
Louisiana.
This is like, Texas. It doesn't, it's not the same. No, it's like, we can basically assume more or less 12, max 13 hour days and nights, right? Like,
it just seems like a lot. It is. Is being nice. Assumed about being able to get her home in time. Not only does he get her home in time before sunrise, but then they also, like...
They still have, like, two hours.
They have, like, sex.
They have,
like,
2 hours.
I don't understand the logistics of this. And, like, I do know that you can drive from parts of Louisiana to parts of Texas, like, fairly easily, but it's, like, Dallas.
Oh,
like,
someone worked this out on a previous... I cannot remember who it was, but someone worked this out on a previous episode, and it's like a 2.5 to 3 hour drive from Shreveport to Dallas.
Yeah.
It's not
it's
far.
It's really not that
all.
Far. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So. But they do make out because Jessica is like, I've been introduced to sex now and I like it, so we're gonna have sex again. And that denim miniskirt look with like the pink bra, like, yes. Yes, please.
Yeah.
It is a good look for her. But of course, then she discovers, unfortunately, that her hymen grew back. I think it's very funny that this show will say a lot of very explicit sexual details, but they can't say the word hymen,
but
which feels
gonna...
like the most gay man thing ever that Alan Ball has ever done.
It does, but it also feels like a thing that Jessica wouldn't say either.
I guess
either.
That's fair. Like... But it's just very funny to me that she's just like, it grew back. I feel bad for her. I really do. As someone who had a really painful first time, like, I can't imagine having to deal with that every single time you have sex. Like, that would be horrible. I did think that... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, so that... Jessica undresses in this scene, and I will say, like, compared to... This is a show where we see a lot of everything from all of the characters. And I thought... I noticed that I thought the direction of this shot her in such a way that it was... It wasn't unsexy, it was sexy, but it wasn't... It didn't feel exploitative. Mm-hmm. Or it didn't feel like prurient in the ways that it could easily have done so. I think the show's direction around sex scenes is generally like, it's very, you know, it's much more explicit, both more or less in both directions, although, you know, within the confines of HBO and television standards, it will show a lot, particularly of couples who are passionate or more mature, but it's much more subtle, I thought, in the way that it's filming Hoyt and Jessica. It's much less, I don't know, I just noticed it compared to like the Tara and Egg scenes we see, or the Sookie and Bill scenes we see, or you know, some of the other sex
well,
scenes.
Even the first time
I
they
just
had
noticed
sex,
the,
they're like
the,
they have the sheets around them and like
sheets
yeah,
up, yeah,
absolutely.
It's yeah. So I just it stood out to me like how different they're shooting this.
I will
scene.
Say, and I think I've brought this up in a previous episode, and I'm sure this will come up. I'm sure this has come up before and it'll come up again. One of the things I don't like about this show, and I understand why they do it, it's because of time, and they don't, like, have time to show, like, a more realistic sexual experience. I don't know know if it would hurt her so much if he spent a little bit more time like helping her out. I'm just saying they go like real fast to penetration in a lot of these sex scenes in a way that I just don't feel like is realistic. Like, I'm just like, even if we're saying that like vampires have some kind of like magical like lubing power, like it feels like some more care should be taken before we jump straight into like the penetrative side of sex. But again, I understand why they do it. It's because they don't have time to show like a long sex scene. Yep. But I feel like,
because of all of the TV shows that show a sensible amount of foreplay,
it's one of those things where I do think a lot of the scenes are very sexy in this show, but it also makes me wince a little bit sometimes, where I'm just like, dude, like maybe spend like 10 more minutes like getting ready. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels, I don't know. Maybe that's what she has to learn. It wouldn't be so difficult if like maybe she made him like do a little bit more down there. But anyway,
that's how you get splinters from sodomizing a pine tree.
Yeah. I did think that I'll be a virgin forever feels like a very sly dig at like, you know, the Catholic image of Mary being a virgin forever. Like, you know, like this idea that it grows back. maybe Mary was a vampire. I don't know. It's just very funny to me, because, you know, Alan Ball is very sacrilegious.
We did get a Jesus mention earlier. Yeah. So like, we've already had the conversations about Jesus was a vampire from Jason. Maybe actually Mary was a vampire and she actually sired Jesus.
I mean, okay. It's no more of a miracle than what we're told happens. So like, you know, I think it's supposed to be horrifying when she says it, but it is also delivered in such a campy way
it is.
Feels kind of funny. Yeah. I will say Hoyt's a great character. He really impresses me again in this scene with how kind he is and how decent he is. He's like always comforting her. He always is very kind to her. He never tries to make her feel bad. I'm not sure everyone has something wrong with them is the best approach to take in this situation. I know he's trying to be like very comforting, like, oh, I'm not perfect, but like, don't say that about people's bodies, dude. Like, I just feel like maybe some other way of talking about this might be more appropriate.
I'm not excusing him. I'm merely saying perhaps not all the blood flow is going to his brain at that time.
That is true. I mean, this was also like, he also for the first time had sex several hours ago in this very long night.
In the same night, yeah. And they drove for 2.5 hours.
So back to the idea that when you're a vampire, healing, this kind of magical healing is not always a good thing.
Yeah, and I think that was going to be the point I sort of brought up. We talked about earlier when we were talking about Godric's tattoo. So the implication is he got tattooed before he became a vampire, because that stuff heals. But it is notable that, as Jessica is a show invention, and again as a gay man, Alan Ballmer's the showrunner on this, that the focus becomes, this is the first true thing that we've had of like, it grows back, it being traumatic, that this sort of healing thing is a traumatic thing. And it's tough not to compare it to Interview with a Vampire, and it's tough not to go, well, this seems to be a problem for women character, female characters, not, not ever employed the same way.
Well, and I will say, like, I do feel like I have to say, I guess I've been assuming this of our listeners as well. Obviously, whether or not you have a hymen is not indicative of your sexual status. Virginity is a made-up concept. It has nothing to actually do with the body or the way that the body works, but it has been applied to certain body types as like a way of valuing them before. I don't think Jessica feels that way about her body. I don't think she like values her virginity in that way. But it is true that there are a lot of people, myself included, who do have a difficult time because of their first time, because of like some of the physical stuff that goes on. That's not true for everybody. It doesn't mean anything. It's just a physical thing. But if you do have that, it would be traumatic, you know, for it to grow back and to have to experience that pain every single time. So she's not right necessarily about the I'll be a virgin forever Again, virginity, not important, not really a thing. But culturally, that's what she's reacting to.
Yeah, it's clear that it's this sort of cultural sense of shame, like she talked about, you know, having a bet with her her friend in middle school about who's going to lose their virginity first. And, you know, her friend was pregnant before she even got a kiss. Yeah. And weirdly, like, that's the second... I'm bringing it up now. I let it go last time, but that's the second thought about Kevin Smith films that I've just had in terms of this. So in Chasing Amy, Ben Affleck is talking to Jerry Lauren Adams, and he's like, "Oh, so you're still a virgin?" And she's like, "Define virginity." And then, like, "Well, you know, the first time you had sex." It's like, "Well, what type of sex?" Or like meaningful sex. "Oh, well, I had meaningful sex with this person I fell hard for." Okay. All right, I change it. "The first time the hymen is broken." Okay, well, in that case, I had I lost my virginity when I fell on a fence pole.
Yeah.
It's like...
Exactly.
You know,
and some people don't even have them, like, to begin with. And, you know, it's funny because Elise and I were talking about this because she saw Hocus Pocus for the first time. A few weeks ago, that movie kind of inverts it by making fun of the male character. Like, they keep bringing up that he's a virgin in a very funny way. And it's not like shaming him or anything. It's just like, you know, he was so stupid because he lit the candle and he was a virgin, you know, like, it's just, it's very funny in that sense, but it is like really weird. The emphasis that we put on like that specific, like, physical anatomy that doesn't really have anything to do with anything. And like you said, there's different kinds of sex. And so, like, it's also a very het view of sex to think that penetrative sex is like the kind that counts, you know? That's a really good connection to bring up Chasing Amy as well.
Yeah, I had a previous earlier thought about Dogma, but that's as much more on the Catholic side. And in terms of the idea of an article of faith to believe that Mary and Joseph never had sex, but it's downright stupid to think that for years of marriage
nothing
happened afterwards.
Them.
Right, we should think about moving on. I think that is our last plot point. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this episode before we move into our
incredible detail.
Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. I've got Godric down as a character intro, but I think we covered him pretty extensively earlier. So what is the most chaotic thing you've got for this episode?
I think you wrote down Marianne's heart souffle, and I have to agree with you because it's really hard. It's hard to say anyone is more chaotic than Marianne when Marianne is in the episode. Like, she's kind of an embodiment of chaos. So, and she makes everyone else act in chaotic ways. So I think you are correct. I think her and her heart souffle are most chaotic here.
Lorena is also pretty chaotic, but in a sort of Real Housewives type of,
like, throw your drink in chaos, another woman's face, like, kind of way.
Yeah. now I really wish that they'd that Sookie had thrown her drink in her
good.
Face. That would have been fun.
She was close. If she had a drink, I think she would have. Yeah.
She was close. She would have. What's most horny?
I think we have to agree that Mike Spencer is probably most horny if he was fucking a pine tree. But I would like to also nominate Jessica, who is so ready to have sex again when they come back to the house that she yells "do me" while straddling Hoyt with her vampire speed.
Yeah, she vampire speeds Hoyt onto a chair, and then it's I think we'll give it to Jessica, just because we don't want to give it to Mike Spencer.
Thankfully, don't see Mike Spencer fucking a pine tree, but we do see Jessica, you know, being very horny with Hoyt. She practically drags him into that house to, like, have sex with him.
Right. She certainly does. It's pretty great. Right, I don't think either of us have read the books, so I think we're sort of probably skip
Elise
the spoilers
and
book sections.
Catch us up next episode.
They can catch us up next time, yeah. So on that basis, Tessa, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Blue Sky and Letterboxd and Storygraph at The Bi Paradox. You can also find me on my other podcast. I have a Terry Pratchett reread podcast with my friend Nigel. We are currently working through all of the Discworld books. As of recording this episode, we have a new episode for Going Postal coming out tomorrow. So that should be out by the time this episode is released. You can find that on Blue Sky at Nanny Ogg's Book Club, and anywhere that you get podcasts. I highly recommend it. It's fun.
I'm very excited about that. Terry Pratchett is one of my favorites, and Nanny Ogg's Book Club is a lot of fun. And Moist Von Lipwig is certainly a character. Right, you can find me on Blue Sky at Lozymandias. You can find me talking about Isaac Asimov. In fact, I have literally just edited, so if you go back in time 2 weeks, you should have 2 or 3 weeks, you should find my first episode of season 2 of Asimov Cast, which will be about the first story in Foundation, The Psychohistorians.
Also a very fun podcast.
Thank you very much.
Would recommend.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I did have a, if anyone wants to hear more of Tessa and I being very chaotic, we talked about robots and science fiction and gender and stuff for a couple of episodes. So long that we split it into two episodes back on the Asimov Cast. Wonderful. Thanks very much to DJ Empirical for our theme, and he is trying to whip Melissa and I into shape in terms of improving our editing skills, so hopefully you'll start getting improvements in audio quality on the podcast soon. You can find the pod on Instagram and Blue Sky at FangbangersPod, and email us your chaotic, horny thoughts on True Blood, please, to fangbangerspod@gmail.com. I'm Lossie, and my blood type is, where is the ass on a pine tree?
And I'm Tessa, and my blood type is inside your wife.
Mm-hmm.
Bye. Bye.